From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Congress and the FCC crept closer to what many see as the cure for unhealthy consolidation in radio broadcasting, low-power FM. I say crept because they started on the road to LPFM 5 years ago, and they're not there yet. In January of 2000, the FCC authorized the service, offering thousands of would-be broadcasters in schools and churches and many erstwhile radio pirates a chance to serve their community. Low-power FM was this close until the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio ascended Capitol Hill with test results showing that the low-power signal would interfere with existing FM stations. Then Congress put on the brakes and pared the service down to just a few hundred stations. Here's how FCC Chairman Bill Kennard reacted 5 years ago.
Well, I'm very disappointed and frankly surprised that an organization like NPR, which has done so much to promote opportunities for Americans to be heard on the airwaves, would join with commercial special interests in trying to kill this promising new service.
Flash forward 5 years, and it turns out that the current conservative FCC chairman, Michael Powell, felt the same way about LPFM as the liberal Bill Kennard. We need it. Powell said this at an FCC forum Tuesday.
I've been told on the phone this morning that Senator McCain will drop the LPFM bill this morning, which will provide new opportunities. So we're off to a fast start in the new Congress, and I am hopeful and excited, and we'll have our full support here at the commission behind trying to make that a reality.
A bill co-sponsored by John McCain seems likely to put LPFM back on the fast track. Or will it? Media maven Rick Carr was at the FCC forum, and he joins me now. Hi, Rick.
It's a pleasure to be here, Brooke.
So let's start with some history. Signal interference. That's a legitimate concern if there really is a chance of interference.
Well, it depends on whose studies you believe. Part of what Congress did back in 2001 when it scaled back the low-power FM or LPFM program is it ordered a test from a company called the MITRE Corporation, which is a nonprofit scientific testing company, does a lot of work for government agencies. The MITRE Corporation report came back and said, really, there is no fear of interference. Now, of course, at this point, the NAB and NPR both say, no, we're still really concerned about this. We have our own tests that indicate otherwise. Really, though, I think most people who've been following this closely in Washington would say it depends on what you mean by interference.
Right. So you're saying NAB and NPR, we're thinking of a different kind of interference.
Well, let's just go to some of the tape that I gathered at this FCC forum last Tuesday. The first piece of tape is from a gentleman named Mr. Paul Billings, who's the general manager of WUVSLP, which is in Muskegon, Michigan, which is a sort of urban music and community service station. He told this to the members of the FCC.
When Arbitron came out, one of my friends from Clear Channel called me and said, low-power FM is number one in our market. You're not going to hear that from Clear Channel, but if you check the ratings for Arbitron, Muskegon, Michigan, low-power FM is number one. Number one, over Clear Channel, all that, number one.
So in that case, we're talking about interference with commercial broadcasters.
Exactly. And there have also been some concerns that low-power FM stations are violating underwriting rules and they're actually selling advertising.
And they're not allowed to. They're supposed to be non-commercial.
Well, they're supposed to follow the same rules that those of us in the public broadcasting world follow.
And so let's move on to NPR then. Its beef probably has something to do with audience as well.
Explicitly, they're only worried about signal interference. Kevin Close, the president of NPR, who I spoke with earlier this week, made it very clear that he is only concerned with signal interference. However, I spoke with a number of Capitol Hill staffers working closely on this issue, and what they're saying is it boils down to money because, of course, in public radio, as in commercial radio, audience is money. There are only so many listeners like you in the audience, and you only have so much money that you're going to give to your local public or LPFM radio station. And in fact, there may be another sort of encroachment going on here that has something to do with money. This is another gentleman who addressed the FCC last Tuesday. His name is Michael Shea, and he is the manager of WRYRLP, which is in Sherwood, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore. He said this.
Now that we have a seat at the table, we'd like a slice of the pie. And that slice of the pie includes the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which distributes $80 million that I know of, that LPFM, who meets the mission of public broadcasting, that we actually are practicing diversity. We are bringing programs to the community.
And you'll hear a public radio broadcaster say that pie is none too big as it is. How dependent is public radio these days on the CPB?
Certainly NPR itself is not that dependent. I mean, after the Republican Congress tried to zero out NPR, as they said back in the 1990s, NPR moved aggressively to get Corporation for Public Broadcasting money out of the core of NPR's funding. But member stations receive a fair amount of money.
Let's turn to the McCain bill. What's in it? What makes it different than what came before? And how will that allow many more low-power FM stations onto the air?
Basically, what this has to do with is spacing between stations. What the FCC originally wanted is essentially two blank spaces between an already licensed broadcaster and a low-power FM station. NPR and the NAB said, no, we think that there should be three blank spaces. And of course, in most urban areas, there are no places on the dial where there are a total of seven blank spaces in a row so that you can slot a low-power FM in there. When Congress stepped in 2001, they basically gave the NAB and NPR what they wanted. What the McCain bill would do is take us back to that two blank space standard, which would allow a lot more stations to come on the air and would allow stations to start coming online in urban areas.
Congress has become a lot more activist since those days back in the 90s. It recently put a roadblock in front of the loosening of media ownership restrictions that Powell wanted to push through. Is this really ultimately all about media consolidation in the end?
Absolutely. Everybody who was at the FCC forum last Tuesday mentioned notions of consolidated ownership and the fact that local radio, for the most part in this country, is, if it's not dead already, especially in the commercial part of the dial, it's dying. LPFM is seen as the antidote to that.
All right. Rick, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Brooke.
Rick Carr reports on media and technology, and you can read more of his thoughts on technopop.org.
3 years before the FCC tried to open up the broadcast spectrum to low-power radio, it divvied up the rights to a new media frontier, a portion of the spectrum that could, in theory, be used to deliver radio via satellite. Only four companies applied to enter the satellite radio race in 1997, and only two got licenses to do so. The companies that would become Sirius and XM paid $90 million each for the right to one half of the satellite radio pie. It took 4 years before this new form of paid radio was actually available to consumers. Up and running since 2001, neither has seen a penny of profit. Which company will see it first? Sirius was quick to raise money and launch a satellite, but now XM has three times as many subscribers. In the February issue of Fast Company magazine, Bill Breen set out to learn how Sirius blew its lead. For one thing, he says, it outsourced its technology and XM didn't.
XM hired a crack team from Motorola, and they did the development of their chipset in-house, and they were able to get that out much faster, so it was ready to then form the second leg of XM's strategy, which was to have it pre-installed in cars, and cars were absolutely critical for XM and Sirius, because after all, cars are the prime radio listening environment.
XM cut its deal with General Motors, which sells a lot of cars.
They sure do.
The Sirius that you describe in your piece is kind of a guy in a $4,000 suit flashing a big bankroll, while XM is a guy, you know, with rolled up sleeves of his work shirt and construction boots building a company in the bad part of town. Does that hold more than kind of superficial interest to us?
Well, I think it signals a little bit about how both companies handle the cash. Both companies have had to go through an enormous burn rate, $250 million just to get a satellite up into orbit. XM has two of them up there. Sirius has three. XM is said to have the largest concentration of IBM servers of any company in the country. You've got to go out and hire big-name talent. They have to spend furiously, and Sirius lived a little bit like a fat cat. They've very expensive quarters in Midtown Manhattan, which is not to say that XM doesn't have its own nice digs, but they're in a northeastern part of Washington, D.C., a rather gritty neighborhood. So it looks like they spend recklessly, but then they try and conserve recklessly as well when they can.
Let's talk about content on-air style. XM's big-name hire was Bob Edwards, late of Morning Edition on NPR, and Sirius's big hire was Howard Stern, whom they're paying something on the order of $100 million a year for him and his staff to produce his show.
Sirius has been trying to attract big-name talent, everyone from Eminem to Tony Hawk. On the XM side, they too have, of course, as you mentioned, Bob Edwards, they have gone for names as well. But it's a lot of sort of homegrown talent. And what I found when I went down there, a lot of them are refugees from the early days of FM who just got tired of playing set playlists and sitting back through long, long chunks of advertising. And in XM, they found a new home because what the programmers there told them is, you know, you go and tell us what music you're going to play. And that was absolutely revolutionary for them.
How do either of these companies defeat the basic problem of satellite radio? People turn on the radio to find out what the traffic is on their commute.
They're not going to beat the local folks playing the local game. That's going to be very difficult for them to do. XM and Sirius do not have to actually defeat Clear Channel and Infinity and make FM and radio go away to win. But what they will do, and most radio analysts agree, is that they will take some market share, and it's going to be interesting to see how much, in fact, they do actually take in the next few years.
There have been a lot of rumors swirling in the last, say, 10 days or so, that these companies are headed for a merger so that there would be no duopoly, there would only be a monopoly. Any reason to believe those rumors?
Of course, officially, they'll say they have no interest. They're interested in growing the company. But I think just the way the media landscape has consolidated over the past few years would lead me to suspect that probably you're going to see the same thing happen in satellite radio as well.
If they do not end up as one entity, which one do you think is going to come out dominant in this race in space?
Well, during the research for the article, I talked to a lot of radio analysts, and they said that the pie is big enough for both of them to do well. But when I talk to people who follow business at large, they said, you know, listen, starting a company is not a marathon. It's really a 100-meter hurdle. And as anyone has ever known from watching a 100-meter hurdle, if you trip at the first hurdle, it's very, very hard to win the race. And Sirius tripped in two areas. One, it tripped over the technology barrier when it took them so long to get the chipsets for the receivers developed. And then it tripped again when it missed that GM deal, and it's still struggling to catch up in the car market. I would have to say that XM right now, it's up to them to lose this sprint for the stars.
Bill Breen, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Breen is the senior project editor of Fast Company magazine.
Coming up, fact-checking some bipartisan whoppers on Social Security and why the kids prefer their papers free.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When we covered the coverage of the State of the Union address last week, media watcher David Brock noted that the fact-checking so prominent on television during the political debates had fallen off. And that's particularly troublesome when the president's biggest issue is nigh on to impenetrable to begin with, Social Security reform or modification or privatization or personalization or whatever. The president spent the week stumping for his plan in friendly states across the country, and his opponents fired back with a fusillade of ads, resulting in a lot of TV heat, but not much light. So we thought we would check in with Brooks Jackson, whose website factcheck.org was widely read during the debates, to see if he could highlight some of the most repeated whoppers from both sides. Brooks, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Brooke.
Is this accurate?
By the year 2042, the entire system would be exhausted and bankrupt.
The term bankruptcy is one that I think does mislead some people because a bankrupt company, of course, gets liquidated, goes out of business. That's not what Social Security is headed for under current projections, either by the Social Security Administration itself or by the more independent Congressional Budget Office. Both say that within a few decades, the Social Security system will exhaust its resources, even the trust fund that it's built up over the years. And at that point, either taxes are going to have to be increased or benefits are going to have to be cut from the levels that they will have reached at that point.
How many decades are we talking about?
Social Security actuaries project the year 2042. Congressional Budget Office think it's got another decade before that happens, 2052.
So what you basically found when you fact-checked this is that bankruptcy is just a misnomer because it doesn't mean that the system goes out of business. It means, in fact, that at most, in 40 or 50 years, people will have reduced benefits of up to 30%.
I don't think we would call it a misnomer. We just note that some people could get the wrong idea from using that term.
You don't call it a misnomer. Why don't you call it a misnomer?
Democrats have used the same term.
Why isn't it a misnomer? Just because it's used badly in a bipartisan way?
We just think that the term bankruptcy can give people the wrong impression, and that's the way we're stating it.
Now, the cornerstone of the Bush plan, personal accounts, in no way addresses Social Security running out of money.
Not according to a senior White House official just before the State of the Union that very day gave an on-the-record briefing for background. And yes, that senior official said personal accounts or private accounts, depending on which term you want to use, would be a wash in terms of helping or hurting the fiscal situation of Social Security because heavy borrowing would be required in the early decades of such a plan.
Do you think it's interesting then, and this is a question of nuance rather than fact, that by placing the impending bankruptcy, as the president puts it, of Social Security next to his plan for personal accounts, he might give the impression that personal accounts somehow addresses the issue of bankruptcy?
Well, I think that's exactly the impression he wants to give. And I believe in his mind, in the mind of many advocates, there is an advantage to doing this.
But not one that addresses the issue of bankruptcy.
In this way, they would say, in order to get changes to the system to make it sustainable over time, some sacrifices are going to be required. And personal accounts are a sweetener that you can offer at least to younger workers, giving them the opportunity, the chance to get a better return over time than they might under the current system. And in that sense, they are part of the solution that the Bush administration foresees.
The assertion that the president made that the personal accounts would yield a higher rate of return, you fact-checked that as well. It's not so clear. Paul Krugman, writing in the New York Times, said it isn't actually likely.
History is on the president's side here. If you look at what the stock market has done historically over the past two centuries, it's returned an average real rate of return after inflation of between 6%, closer to 7%. But it's not guaranteed, of course. The president in the State of the Union said these accounts will do better over time. Well, that's not certain.
Bush also described the money this way.
And best of all, the money in the account is yours, and the government can never take it away.
True or false?
True, only in a very limited sense. That money is not going to be yours to do with what you want while you're working. You can't take it out. You can't get a loan against it. You can't invest it in anything but the broad mutual funds, maybe four or five of them, that the government says you can. And once you retire, even then, most or all of the money, depending on your situation, is going to have to go to purchase an annuity, a guaranteed stream of income for life. And for a lot of people, perhaps even the majority or the vast majority, that's going to be all the money.
Now, you've also fact-checked a few of the organizations with a stake in Social Security overhaul. Let's start with the MoveOn.org TV ad.
First, someone thought up the working lunch. Then we discovered the working vacation. And now, thanks to George Bush's planned Social Security benefit cuts of up to 46% to pay for private accounts, it won't be long before America introduces the world to the working retirement.
Well, what you don't see on radio is that some white-haired persons, obviously all of them over 65, lifting boxes and shoveling and mopping floors. The clear impression that this ad's created to make is that people who are over 65 are going to have their benefits cut up to 46%. That's just not true. The president said over and over again that nobody over age 55 now would be affected. We called it a false ad because of the juxtaposition of words and pictures.
And you also took issue with the print ad produced by the AARP, which is the largest lobbying group for seniors.
That's a full-page newspaper ads appeared a lot of places, basically making the point that there will be some risk involved in these personal accounts or private accounts, whichever terminology you use. And that's right. What they're showing is a commodities trading pit where, if you look closely in the background, sugar futures and cocoa futures are being traded. And that's just an absolute false representation of the particular kind of risk that's envisioned for these accounts. Broad mutual funds is what you'll be allowed to invest in. You're not going to be allowed to speculate in cocoa futures.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brooks Jackson is the director of Annenberg Political Fact Check, otherwise known as factcheck.org.
A couple of weeks ago, the editor of a weekly Georgia newspaper got a call that really annoyed him. It was from a PR firm representing Walmart, and it was offering interviews aimed at improving the megastore's tarnished image. Jackson Herald editor Mike Buffington, who also happens to be president of the National Newspapers Association, an organization of community newspapers, wasn't interested. He felt that Walmart, which has done very little local newspaper advertising, was looking for favors in all the wrong places. Buffington shot off an irate letter to Walmart CEO H. Lee Scott that has since circulated widely. In it, he asks, why is it that community newspapers in America are good enough to help you fend off critics with free PR, but we're not good enough for your paid advertising? Here to discuss the flap is the angry newspaperman himself, Mike Buffington. Welcome to On the Media.
Good to be here, Bob.
All right, Mike, tell me about this phone call and what precisely bugged you about it.
Well, it was actually an email and came from a PR firm in Atlanta that Walmart had retained to contact newspapers about their nationwide PR campaign. And given that Walmart has basically ignored local newspapers, community newspapers across America, I thought it was strange that they were now turning to us and wanting us to help them get out of a jam.
I thought journalism was all about separating the advertising side from the editorial side and that no editorial decision is supposed to be based in any way on what's going on the business side.
Well, I don't think it's a quid pro quo arrangement at all, even though I'm sure some people may read that into it. But Walmart has basically insulted community newspapers. One of their top executives was interviewed back in the fall, and she made the observation that they love having their employees' pictures in local newspapers for good PR. And if that's the case, then if they do value us, then why not occasionally show that in some other ways besides asking for something free?
Because news is free? Because editorial judgments are supposed to be made based on the news value and nothing else. You've said that you don't regard this as a quid pro quo, and yet what you're expressing to me is exactly that, that having abandoned the small newspapers as an advertising medium, Walmart has surrendered the right to get coverage, favorable or otherwise.
That's not what I'm saying at all. In fact, in one of our newspapers today, we have a letter to the editor praising Walmart for helping with some charity events. And we do a lot of stories related to what Walmart does in the community, and we don't get advertising from Walmart. But I think there's a difference between, and a real distinction between public relations and news. And in my view, in our market, what they wanted us to do was public relations and not news.
But every single day, I imagine, you get flacked by some organization or another or its proxies and PR firms. Don't you get other press releases that you go, yeah, that's a pretty good idea, and let's take a look at this story?
Sure, and sometimes there's a nugget of an idea there that does lead to a pretty good news story. But we do get a lot of news releases that never see the light of day in print because they are not really substantial news. It's public relations. And that's kind of how I read what Walmart was trying to do in contacting community newspapers, was to manipulate us in a way that I felt was rather insulting.
Let me put the question to you this way. Community newspapers, deservedly or undeservedly, do not have the finest reputation in the newspaper business because it is widely known that at some papers, I have no idea what percentage, in order to get favorable coverage for your local business, you are expected to be first in advertiser. It's kind of a throwback to the bad old days, but nonetheless, it persists. When the president of the National Newspapers Association states a case which looks an awful lot like quid pro quo, aren't you damning your entire membership with an image that would do all of your members well to break away from?
I think your premise is wrong. I think most community newspapers in America today are more professional than that. We get pressure sometimes from advertisers to run news releases that really don't meet the standard of news, and if they don't meet the standard of news, we don't run them. And that's certainly not what I was saying. What I was saying is that Walmart ignores community newspapers in this country to a large extent until they want something for free, and then they turn to us to try to help them out of this jam with their critics in a way that I felt was very manipulative.
All right, well, let's leave it there. Mike, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Mike Buffington is the president of the National Newspapers Association, an organization representing 3,200 community newspapers. He's also editor and co-publisher of the Jackson Herald and an owner of Mainstream Newspapers Incorporated.
Small-town newspapers are always looking for revenue, but big-town papers are too. One increasingly popular strategy is to give them away. Currently, there are two new free dailies competing for readers in the Big Apple, and last month, the New York Times announced that it planned to buy 49% of a free paper up north called the Boston Metro. The Washington Post has been offering a free paper to subway riders in the nation's capital, and just last week, another freebie emerged there called the Examiner. Reporter Lizzie O'Leary has the scoop on free newspapers, though we did have to pay her for it.
5 days a week, Christopher Ma publishes the Washington Post's free daily paper, Express. Like several other major newspaper companies, the Post dipped its toes into the free media pool and found a ready audience of upscale young readers who weren't paid subscribers.
If you get on the train each morning and look at who's reading it, it's a pretty good profile of the sort of reader that the newspaper industry generally has had a hard time attracting in recent years.
And so, I did.
Door closing.
This Washington subway car is filled with about 50 commuters. They're overwhelmingly young professionals, and they're clutching briefcases, backpacks, the occasional Krispy Kreme donut, and a lot of newsprint. The Washington Post and the New York Times peep out from a few people's bags. Some are leafing through the new Examiner. But most of the car is a sea of little blue, hip Express mastheads.
My name's Genevieve. I'm reading the Washington Post Express, and it's just a quick, easy distraction on my short commute.
My name is Chris, and I just picked up a free copy of the Examiner Washington.
My name's Alex, and I'm reading the Express magazine, which is published by the Washington Post.
What are those readers' ages? 25, 35, and 31. For the advertisers whose dollars support free commuter dailies, they're demographic gold. Metro International, the Swedish company that pioneered the commuter daily, began targeting young readers in the subways of Stockholm in 1995. Today, Metro publishes 42 free papers in 17 countries, including the U.S., and their advertising sales have grown 47% in the past decade. Recently, the company came under fire after an executive allegedly made racist remarks and a board member resigned. Still, Metro's business model has made traditional publishers around the world pay attention.
Free represents a laser by which publishers can carve up a market for advertisers seeking the right kind of audience.
Earl Wilkinson is the executive director of the International Newspaper Marketing Association and has analyzed the explosion of free dailies.
Metro, for example, in Stockholm today, their profit margins are approaching 35%, which would be dream economics of most paid daily newspapers in the United States.
And traditional publishers are also trying the Metro model. Besides the Times and the Post, the Tribune Company and Belo have also gotten into the free daily business. And their papers now reach readers in Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Dallas, and Washington. But even if the Metro model is good business, is it really good journalism? In an essay in January's Columbia Journalism Review, its publisher, Evan Cornog, described free commuter papers as geared to the attention span of a mayfly.
I did say that, and, you know, it's clearly one of the great problems that the newspaper business faces today, that they want to reach out to the youth market, but everything that they believe says that younger readers are not willing to invest time in the newspapers that older readers are.
Hence the 20-minute commuter read. And the splashy designs, tight copy, and fun graphics. And also a certain melding of hard news with celebrity sightings. I asked Cornog what he thought about readers leafing past a photo of actress Naomi Watts to get to a story about the Iraqi elections.
The question here is whether enough good information about serious topics is being gotten to the people who are reading those newspapers. The ones I've seen I find very unsatisfying. It's a little bit like having a diet that's all donuts.
But can a newspaper both deliver the demographic that advertisers crave and make readers eat their journalistic vegetables? Or maybe, as Express publisher Christopher Ma hopes, can free commuter dailies represent just a starting point for new readers?
We see Express as helping to develop a whole new generation of newspaper readers in print as well as online. We are using the paper to make the readers of Express more aware of what is in the Washington Post each day.
Earl Wilkinson isn't sold on that concept. He says there's some evidence from Europe that Free Daily readers have graduated to broadsheets a couple of times a week.
But we've got to get out of the mentality that we're simply going to use this as a teaser, and they're going to drop the teaser at some point, and they're going to embrace the big, bulky broadsheet. I think that's probably a fantasy.
The reality, though, is that the public appetite for free dailies still seems to be growing. Geneva Overholzer sits on the faculty of the Missouri School of Journalism and applauds investment and innovation in newspapers. Still, she worries about the precedent that free dailies might set.
We need to do good, hard reporting. And if we more and more are giving away the news on the internet or in these free dailies, what is the commercial model that we're going to find that will enable us to pay for good old-fashioned journalism? It's a very costly thing.
Overholzer hopes that free dailies can keep broadening the media spectrum and attracting new readers without compromising the fundamental editorial mission of flagship papers. Of course, the knowledge of how to strike that balance is probably priceless. For On the Media, I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
Coming up, the mystery man hiding in plain sight in the White House press room, and why an episode called Sugar Time went sour on PBS.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women, and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, with one letter to stand in for several we received on a recent segment we did on comics. Jim Ottaviani of Ann Arbor, Michigan writes, "In your piece about Stan Lee and his lawsuit, you didn't cover two significant parts of the story. First, Stan Lee did not sue to get profits he thought he was entitled to merely on ethical grounds as co-creator of the properties. He sued to enforce a contract he'd signed with Marvel. Second, contrary to the hedging you did in your introduction, Lee created none of the characters you mentioned by himself. He never drew a single line of art, and in a visual medium, that's significant. There were always co-creators. Fantastic Four, co-created with Jack Kirby. X-Men, co-created with Jack Kirby. The Hulk, co-created with, you guessed it, Jack Kirby. Spider-Man, co-created with Steve Ditko. Daredevil, co-created with Bill Everett. I'll spare you the geeky details of how Lee and Kirby or Ditko or Everett typically created their characters and stories. It's common knowledge in the comics industry, and published material on the process is very easy to find. In the 60-minute soundbite you aired, Mr. Lee sounded hurt about his company's treatment of him. In most interviews he gives, the fact that his co-creators have not received even 1% of the profits from the vast earnings their creativity generated never gets on the air. He also rarely mentions their names, and reporters rarely do either. You didn't. Please keep your letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Hey, Buster, where you up to? What you up to, Buster? Where you up to now?
You may have heard in the news recently about a cartoon rabbit named Buster Baxter. He travels around North America visiting real-life families as part of a public television show called Postcards from Buster. It's a production of WGBH in Boston, which received a large grant from the Department of Education to create a children's program that showcases diversity. For example, Buster stops off in Salt Lake City, Utah, where he meets a Mormon family, and he explores the local Chinatown of San Francisco. In one very recent episode, Buster finds himself in Hinesburg, Vermont, population 5,000. Buster learns how to make maple syrup from a young girl named Emma, and we learn that Emma has two mothers.
Hi, Buster. I'm Gillian.
Hi, Gillian.
Hi. You want to come on in? Karen, here's Buster and Bo. Buster.
Hi, Karen. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Bo.
DOE's new secretary, Margaret Spellings, objected to that episode called Sugar Time, and perhaps coincidentally, PBS decided not to distribute it to its member stations. Many parents would not want their young children exposed to the lifestyles portrayed in this episode, wrote Spellings in a letter to the CEO of PBS, Pat Mitchell. In a defiant move, WGBH has made copies of Sugar Time directly available to all affiliates. So far, only around 40 have decided to air it. The majority, some 300, including Alabama Public Television, have said no. The executive director of APTV, Alan Pizzato, was quoted in the New York Times saying, "We don't want to violate the trust parents have with us." Joining us from Birmingham is Alan Pizzato. Alan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Love being here.
What were the major considerations for APTV in deciding whether to air the episode?
Parents are not in front of the TVs with their children normally in the afternoons. Given that it is a controversial issue, it's not something that we wanted to present to children without parents being responsible for deciding when they wanted to present this issue to children. And we made our decision almost a week before anything came down from the Department of Education or PBS in terms of canceling the program.
Now, in a recent episode on Alabama Public Television, Buster visited San Antonio, Texas, where he met a 12-year-old Mexican-American boy. Some have argued that ethnic differences are simply one part of the diversity that is the reality of our society, and that to ignore gay parents is, in a way, to ignore reality.
Well, ethnic society is a little bit different issue in terms of being presented to children. We looked at this as it was dealing with an issue of gay or lesbian parents that is not totally accepted by all people in the state of Alabama.
If parents in your viewership indicated that they didn't want their children exposed to images of interracial couples, how would you respond?
Interracial couples is accepted by society. It's accepted in Alabama. It doesn't mean everybody likes that. It is also accepted in the courts. It is not as big an issue as the gay and lesbian issue is today, especially in Alabama. I think that still this all boils down to children and what we're exposing to children without the parents being around to make the decision of whether they should see this or not.
Gay parents are also legally defended in the courts. So how do you determine which social norm has met that level of acceptability?
We just look at it as what we think the majority of the parents in Alabama would think if they found out that we provided this to their children without them knowing it.
This is a tricky question, and I think it's especially tricky for public broadcasters. But in a program like Postcards from Buster, the intention was, and I actually have here what the original grant application by the Department of Education called for, diversity will be incorporated into the fabric of the series to help children understand and respect differences and learn to live in a multicultural society. What does that mean if gay people are allowed to live together and even have children together, then why is it that they can't fall into the category of the sorts of images and differences that children are supposed to be able to understand and respect?
I think the fact that we're having this conversation and the fact that it's been in the New York Times and the fact that it's a public issue demonstrates that it is not the same as interracial couples or other ethnic groups, and that there is a difference.
But Alan, we're only having this conversation because PBS decided to pull the episode.
We would have been having this conversation if PBS had not decided to pull the episode. There would have been a great uproar. The Secretary of Education would have written the letter. That right there would have provided the conversation. And I'm not saying the conversation is a bad one. I think it's a good one.
Do you think there's a political component here? When the Secretary of Education starts asking for grant money to be returned, as she did in this case, does that get your attention?
Well, as I said, we made our decision a week before that was ever done. To us, it really was not a political decision. Parents in one area of the country, especially in the Vermont area, would probably see this as totally appropriate. In other states and other areas, they would not see it as appropriate. Whether right or wrongly, which is really not the issue, we know that parents would have been extremely upset if we would have aired that program. They appreciate that it is a safe haven. And they appreciate that they don't have to think or worry about what their children are seeing or learning or hearing on Alabama Public Television. And in my mind, this whole thing boiled down to, will The majority of parents in Alabama feel that they were betrayed by Alabama Public Television and be upset over the fact that this aired.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan Pizzotto is the executive director for Alabama Public Television in Birmingham, Alabama. So that was the interview. Obviously, we recorded it earlier. But before we stopped taping, suddenly another voice chimed in. It was the engineer recording Alan Pizzotto's end of the conversation at a commercial station in Birmingham, Courtney Hayden, a longtime APTV viewer.
Brooke, if you don't mind, I've just met Alan for the first time just a few minutes ago, and speaking as a subscriber to Alabama Public TV, understand that this isn't the kind of fight you want to pick for Alabama Public TV at this time.
That's very interesting.
We understand in Alabama that public broadcasting has ever been an endangered species, and APT depends so much on public support financially that if he stirs up something like this that would jeopardize their funding among a core demographic, I think that Alan made, at least on that level, whether consciously or subconsciously, that was exactly the right decision. And I think that just because public broadcasting is taken for granted in other parts of the country, over the years, it has brought an amazing diversity of programming to a state which otherwise, I think, might never have seen it. It's a precious jewel here in the reddest of the red states.
But my comment is, and I appreciate his comment, but the whole issue of jeopardizing funding and people being upset, we deal with that from time to time with a lot of different issues over programming that we air. That's not what this decision was all about.
Well, thank you very, very much for that, too. I feel like I got a twofer.
Yesterday it rained in Tennessee. I heard it also rained in Tallahassee. But not a drop fell on little old me, 'cause I was in sugar town.
For the first 4 years of the Bush administration, this program railed about its message discipline, its secrecy, and its avoidance of media scrutiny. The second Bush term has expanded the palette of outrages, from Condoleezza Rice demanding to pre-screen questions from students in a Q&A session at a French university, to government payments for Armstrong Williams and at least two other pundits flogging the administration's policies. But for sheer tongue-wagging value, it's hard to match the JG affair.
Senate Democratic leaders have painted a very bleak picture of the U.S. economy. Harry Reid was talking about soup lines, and Hillary Clinton was talking about the economy being on the verge of collapse. Yet, in the same breath, they say that Social Security is rock solid and there's no crisis there. How are you going to work? You've said you're going to reach out to these people. How are you going to work with people who seem to have divorced themselves from reality?
That's Jeff Gannon of the conservative politics website Talon News. Actually, formerly of Talon News. He and Talon parted ways this week when sleuthing bloggers figured out that the lobber of presidential softballs isn't Jeff Gannon at all, but a fellow named James Guckert, who, in addition to having certain skeletons in his closet, has been working with a White House daily press pass under an assumed name. Lots of people use professional names, but nonetheless, last week found many people scrambling to explain themselves. One of them was White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, who acknowledged Thursday that he knew about Gannon's nom de plume, but said the credentialing process is none of his beeswax. That response wasn't good enough for Democratic New Jersey Senator Frank R. Lautenberg, who pounced on this latest embarrassment to demand all materials from the White House relating to the credentialing of the fictitious J.G. Whether the senator was actually outraged or simply delighted about the dust-up, his press release didn't say. For the record, the White House categorically denies that Gannon was a paid shill of the Armstrong-Williams variety, and that may well be true. Another question is whether a self-declared ideologue with no previous professional journalism experience should have been credentialed under any name. His answer is, well, why not?
I write for Talon News, and I take no editorial direction from anyone. Nobody feeds me questions. I have full rein to choose my subject matter. Now, I've been covering the White House for 2 years, and usually my stories focus on what the White House says or some issue that the White House has commented on. But the notion that this is some kind of political activist organization is incorrect.
Bob Deans is White House correspondent for Cox Newspapers and former president of the White House Correspondents Association. He sat next to Gannon in the press room, and he says the man has a point.
It's very tricky because we have not wanted to put ourselves in the position of saying, gee, this guy's a legitimate journalist and this guy isn't. You know, it's a trade, not a profession. I don't have a certificate hanging on my wall here saying I'm an authorized journalist, thank goodness.
On the other hand, Deans says,
I think the American people have a hard enough time trying to decide who they should trust for their news without the daily White House briefing room turning into crossfire.
And in the role of Bob Novak, TalonNews.com, a sister website of GOP USA, founded by Texas Republican Bobby Eberle. Its declared mission is to, quote, spread the conservative message throughout America through news, commentary, and activism. On Friday, Gannon acknowledged that his sympathies lie with the Bush administration, but he took pains to note the distinction between Talon.com and its GOP USA affiliate, and expressed anger that he was being publicly flayed as, in his words, a political hack.
Why does every question to the President of the United States have to be hostile? He took my question and he spoke to it, and part of the press conference is for him to be able to speak to the press and to the American people on whatever he wants to say. And my question provided that opportunity. I think I got one of the best answers of the day out of him.
As to how he actually qualified for a job in the White House press corps, Gannon cited his diverse work and life experience.
Well, I've been an entrepreneur. I've helped businesses do startup. I was doing some website development. I drove a truck once. I have a teaching certificate, and I taught a high school for a year. I've done a lot of things in my life.
The latest being White House correspondent for Talon News, where, for example, during the campaign, he attacked John Kerry as a coddler of gays. Nothing remarkable about that, per se, except that Gannon, in his brief experience as a website developer, was the registrant of record for some homoerotic-sounding website names, notably HotMilitaryStud.com. That revelation may have been his undoing at Talon, which has since deleted from its site all stories written by Gannon, as well as many stories on gay issues. The juicy tidbit certainly made the JG affair the talk of Washington this week, but the real issue isn't sexual hypocrisy. The issue is whether the White House is avoiding real journalists and playing the wink-wink-nudge-nudge game with ringers. Gannon asks,
what's wrong with that? Just because I'm not hostile to the President of the United States in a press conference, that somehow I'm not doing my job?
Well, here's the answer. Yes, James or Jeff or whatever your name is, you're doing your job, but not journalism's job. Sure, the press corps is occasionally rough on the Bush administration, albeit not nearly enough to suit our tastes. But they are equally rough on Democratic administrations, as Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, and Bill Clinton can more than attest. The press's job calls for harsh questioning, a job in no way balanced by blowing kisses to those in power. On the contrary, every question is precious, squandering the ever-shrinking opportunity to confront the commander-in-chief for accountability is not only anti-journalistic, it's an affront to democracy. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Ann Kosseff, and Mike Wallow, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz, and editing help from Jeff Rogers. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the New School in New York City, offering an interdisciplinary graduate program in media studies. Fall application deadline March 15th. Information at nsu.newschool.edu/PRI. Also from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James R. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.